everyone, and welcome to Series 2 of Curious Emotion, a podcast from Curious Motion. I'm Sam McCormick, and I'm so excited to be back. Have you noticed that we've got new music? A huge thank you to musician Rich Huxley for this beautiful original score. We love it and are excited to release it into the world. This series is themed around the values we hold at Curious Motion, the things we believe are important and integral across all of our work. We have 6 values at Curious Motion, and whilst we know what we mean by them, we want to find out what they mean to other people and what we can all learn by delving further into them. Do check out the bonus episode to hear more about why we chose this theme and about our new music tea. So, let's get into today's chat. This episode kicks us off with our first value, artistry. What does artistry mean for our lives and the world around us? Well, today we are joined by inspiring dancer Theo Clincard to explore this and more. Theo's current practice spans choreography, design, performance, and pedagogy. Following 20 years dancing for some of the UK's most celebrated choreographers, he launched his own company in 2012 and has steadily built an international reputation for creating affecting and visually arresting work for small, middle, and large-scale theatres, as well as non-theatre settings. I've followed Theo's work for a long time and have always been drawn to his empathetic and curious approach to what art is and what this means for society. So I'm really excited to bring you this chat. It's so in-depth and honest, filled with warmth and discovery. So let's go and meet Theo. Now, we recorded this episode just as the tragic death of Sarah Everard was coming to light here in the UK. So with that in mind, let's get into our chat.
Hi Sam.
Thanks for being here. It's lovely to see you.
For welcoming me onto your podcast. I'm glad to be part of it.
Oh no, it's lovely to have you. So you're here today to have a chat about artistry. So I thought we could start with a question for you. And that is, what does artistry mean to you?
So you might laugh, but I had to Google it.
I love that.
I know I have some sense of what I think it means, but I was like, what does it really mean? And what is my relationship to it? And so I've been thinking about how I know people who don't identify as artists, or they're not in a kind of professional field of art making, but they live their life in such a way that there's a attention to detail or a care about how they are in the world or the things that they work on or the language that they use or how they are with people, which is artistic. And so my brain, after your invite around this word, was like, what are the ways in which there is an artistry or an artistic practice for us as people in the world, which is before or beyond or around the edges of what we actually produce? So to detach it from the professionalization. And I suppose that's been a theme for me a little bit through lockdown and before, because I started a sabbatical a while back, was like, how do I think of my practice beyond a kind of profile of being a choreographer or a dancer or a designer? But I take away that kind of avatar, if you like, or online presence, what is left? And do I live through the values that I care about? And how else might I be artistic? And what are the other ways it can show up, even in how I write an email or something like that? So yeah, just an expanded idea of what artistry or art, it's not even art making, but being an artist might be. That was my initial thought.
I love that. I think that's where Curious Motion's coming from as well. It is hard to put into words because it can be easily stereotyped or assumptions are made about what art is or something. You know, it's this part of our lives that we haven't, sometimes it's hard to find a word for, but I think you've just summed that up really beautifully.
I have a dear friend who has had various jobs. He mostly works in ceramics, but like he's an amazing cook. And I think like when I eat his food, I'm like, this is the food of an artist, you know, somehow. Then I think like artistry can show up in so many different ways. And then it feels like a way of life, and that anyone has access to it, because it's not about the attention given or the value given to what you produce within a certain niche circle and the codes that you reinforce with each other, but how someone might make you feel by the way they give you their full attention, like artistry in the kind of broadest sense, being available to everyone and something that everyone can live by.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you what role you think artistry plays in society. So I suppose that's it, isn't it? It's that it being part of everybody's lives in many different ways.
Well, I think for me, there's something, and when you emailed me, you mentioned this actually, like something really important about empathy, and that art can be a way in which we can bridge a gap between ourselves and others, maybe across borders of all kinds, different disciplines or cultures. So I'm curious about how, primarily for me, how dance can engender empathy between the people you work with, between audiences and performers, between audience and audience, between venue and locale, between venue and venue, like one of the different matrixes, is that the right word? But where empathy could play out or be practiced or enhanced or developed. And, you know, I think we all have that capacity. And it's interesting to think how the lockdown has perhaps made ourselves feel more isolated. And then in another sense, and this is different for everyone, but in another sense, I also feel like I'm more in touch with the people I like and care about through things like this. So actually more, not networked in the professional sense, but more networked in a kind of lovely spider's web across different places and countries. And, you know, we're going through a collective experience. So empathy plays out in like, ah, how are you coping? What are your strategies? Or, you know, I feel like it's a time for recognizing difference and the empathy around that, as well as what we share somehow.
Oh, there's so much in that, Theo, we could talk about. Yeah, it's really true. And I think it's, I mean, when I've been asking guests, which of our values would you like to talk about? And another one of them is empathy, and another one of them is compassion. And then I think to myself, all of these are linked. They're all the same. They're all the same thing in a way. They all link into that human nature, that care for each other, those elements that you just mentioned there about connecting, spending that time on the people you care about, all of this stuff. I think it's so valuable, and I would agree the lockdown has maybe enhanced some of that for us.
I think also there's something about artistry and empathy and lockdown, which is something about more, even though it's not kind of fleshy in-person participation, I feel like even with like, what's his name who does the warm-ups, the kind of the gym fitness thing.
Joe Wicks,
yeah. I know it's not like art making, but like I suppose practices of togetherness in a kind of wide sense. And even Grayson Perry's and Philippa Perry's art club, I've also not engaged in that, having said this. But like, for example, there's morning practice, which is run out of Wainscote Chapel in Hebden Bridge, where I've been living. And that's been a way in which, you know, it's kind of like a dance party from 9 till 10 every morning, £2 or pay what you want. And people, dancers, non-dancers, amateurs, enthusiasts from all around the world are taking part. So I feel like I'm dancing with people I've never met. I'm dancing with people around the globe and sharing something through this little kind of window lens of the screen, which feels supportive. And, you know, we are in our different spaces in every sense, but connected in a, through the music, I suppose, for want of anything, you know, as well as other things. And I'm just thinking about the ways in which, even through maybe, I don't know, homeschooling, I don't know, I feel like it's an interconnectedness. And I'm just thinking about participation, I suppose. There's something for me at the moment around the importance of participation in dance and other art forms. It's that, you know, we mostly, even if we become primarily an audience member for dance, we usually come into it, our love for it is developed through taking part. And I'm interested to think about how taking part is expanded through the online, not just a reduced or compromised version of what we enjoyed in person. I think there's no way of replicating what we have in person. I'm also trying to not be like Debbie Down and negative on it, because actually it opens up something about geography, for example.
Yeah, definitely. I've been to the morning practice sessions as well, and they are so... Honestly, the first one I came to, I've been meaning to come to it for a really long time. I kept seeing it pop up on Instagram and everything. I was thinking, oh, Sam, come on, you need to come on. You need to do this. And you know what it's like? It's like, oh, God, I've got emails to do, whatever. And actually, that first session was just like, it was really emotional. I just thought, oh, my God, look at all these people. And then I was like, oh, no, look who that is. And all these faces of people I might not know, but I've heard of, or people I don't know at all that are, you know, a mile down the road, and people who are in other parts of the world. And it is so beautiful. And then to have the music and the dance and the freedom within that for it to be for you as well as being connected to other people is just absolutely beautiful. And I think that is something that we've been offered via online that we can't really do in person.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I was doing morning practice a little bit before lockdown happened. So it was in person in Hebden Bridge. And what I loved about it, which I still love about it, is that you've got dancers of all kinds and people who maybe don't identify as dancers but love dancing who are from the town. So in the same way online, my dad's doing it upstairs, I'm doing it downstairs. And this sort of like, yeah, kind of egalitarian approach, you know, and those, like, my dad wouldn't necessarily turn up at a dance class. And I'm sure many other people wouldn't, but because it feels like a gentler offer, like, why not give it a try? I can always close the laptop if I don't like it. I've recommended it to all kinds of, like, I put it online, but I've recommended it to, like, artists and actors and, you know, people who don't necessarily use movement as their primary focus, but enjoy moving. And I think, you know, what I've learned is that the days I don't do it, I'm missing those happy chemicals. So it's really, in that sense, a lifeline, I think, for a lot of us, that we are having that kind of stimulation of mind-body flow of chemicals that keeps us going.
I mean, that's happening physiologically and emotionally and on a level that we can only really understand by experiencing it. Absolutely. And just to go back to your point about participation being the route into an art form for many people, if you know, for audience members and... Mm. I'm really biased because all my work is participatory in some respect. So I always feel like I'm just, you know, going on about it and have been going on about it for 20 years. I think it's a really important point. And I suppose things like the morning practice sessions and the Zoom opportunities, the online opportunities, I would hope maybe that that's increasing participation in some ways. I know there are still barriers and I wonder what that might do for artistry, I suppose, in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, yeah, potentially, I don't know the statistics, but potentially it's reaching a lot more people, or it's making more global. Like, you could tune in with something which is happening in Melbourne, you know, and be witness to it in the way that people are within that city, because they're also on screen, you know, so it's broadening somehow. But I was writing something the other day and considering how when we come out of lockdown, I don't know if that's even really going to be a thing, but like other versions of lockdown back into being in shared spaces, I don't know how much I'm going to want to sit there and watch something. Like, I'm really missing, like, and I'm not a big clubber, but like, I'm really missing going out, you know, and like being sweaty on a dance floor with good music. I'm missing that more than sitting in a big theatre watching expertise from some company who's flown over to the UK. You know, like, it's the visceral, fleshy, sweaty, throbbing, dancey experience, which I'm really craving, you know, because we're mostly on our own, a lot of us. So it's...
I'm with you on that. And I am not at all a clubber or... but I, you know, every time I see something on the TV where someone's out at a party, I'm like, oh my God,
it's so triggering.
It's awful but also amazing.
Yeah, it's like a combination of concern. Yes. For them, like, you're... Yes. Too close, but then like, oh, it's been so long since I felt that collective energy. So whilst with morning practice, for example, there's faces all over your screen from all around the world, it's not the same. And I think we mustn't confuse these things as being the same. And as someone who really cares about touch and empathy and connection. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing new what I'm saying. It's just that as we come out of it, there might be brilliant, there already is, like, brilliant hybrid festivals of online and in-person festivals. So where work is accessible in different ways, but I know that I'm missing the actual contact. So another aspect of that for me is the exclusivity around this show happens once in London. It's very expensive and you were either there or you weren't. Time for that to end. It's like smaller audiences more often. Like I even saw something that was put online at a certain time and a few people commented like, oh, it's such a shame it's right at whatever it was, dinner time or right when I feed the kids or whatever. Like, and the company responded, I think it might have been Encounter, like, well, actually, let's do another one at 5 because there's enough people that will miss out. And we can respond to that. We could just shift the time of that screening or streaming. And I was just thinking, oh, yeah, that suddenly makes things accessible in a different way. Like more often, if it's in person, maybe fewer people, but more often, I know there's economic constraints. But like the exclusive thing as it's, the value around exclusivity is problematic, and it always was, and this has exposed some of those things, I think.
Yeah, the value around exclusivity, that's a really good point.
I think there's something really key in like how much pie do we take up, like as a white cis neurotypical non-disabled man, like what space do I take up online, what space does my work take up in person, like, and just reorganizing that. And I think there's been a lot of consciousness around that in who's invited to the table. You know, it's also been a big learning, I think, or should be.
So your newest project called Century Project, it would be lovely to know a bit more about that. Can you give us a little summary?
Yeah. I've not spoken about it for a while, so it's an interesting challenge to like, what comes to the foreground? Because it's quite complex. Each time I dive into it, I'm like, where to start? But basically, I think there's something really important about referencing, acknowledging your references. And there's a great piece of work called Future Library in Norway. So in 2014, they opened up a new library in Oslo. And as part of that, an artist was commissioned to make an artwork. And they invited a Scottish artist called Katie Patterson to create a new work. And she decided to chop down part of the forest outside Oslo with the wood, build a wooden room, like a library inside of the library, with a little window pointing towards where the trees had grown. Each year over the next 100 years, a different writer is commissioned to write a novel or write a book, but the work is never published. So it's kept under lock and key, and little vaults in the walls of this wooden library, a new one each year. So it accumulates 100 books which are never read until the saplings that she planted where the trees had been are mature enough to be turned into books. So the stories get printed in 100 years' time and are available to be read. So I read this in an in-flight magazine and it totally blew my mind. I was like, this is the most extraordinary way to, for example, think about empathy. Like, who is that generation of young readers, like, who are not even thought about yet, let alone being born, you know, perhaps? So how can we empathize for another generation? How can we think about, therefore, climate through that lens of longitudinal work? So basically, Future Library is one of many longitudinal artworks, of which there are sound works. So Jem Finer has a piece. Jem Finer was in the Pogues and he created an artwork in about 2000, so a Millennium artwork, which was an Art Angel project, which is a 1,000 year continuous piece of music, which is being played right now and has been already for 21 years perhaps. So I started to research these different pieces of work. There's an amazing one called As Slowly as Possible, which is a John Cage piece, which has been stretched out over 680 years and is being played right now on an organ in a little church in Germany. So I was a bit like, well, what would the dance version of this be? What would it be like to look at movement, look at time in this way? And what does, Yeah, what is it? How might I use dance in a different way? What I started with was something akin to like the Sleeping Beauty project. So a dance which is created. I was thinking a bit about ballerinas who come back and pass their role on, like the swans, you know, the previous generation coaching the next generation. So the verbal, oral tradition of dance. So could we make a work, pass it on to another group, pass it on to another group through different generations of dancers, but it's all kept hidden, if you like, maybe within like a university system or something like that, that maybe needed some kind of structure, but it's premiered for the first time in 100 years. And what is that process of storing a work in the body, remembering it, practicing it, and teaching it on? And I applied for some funding and we did some research nearly 2 years ago now. And this piece has, by the way, been 6 years in the planning. So I've been for so long and it kept changing. So when we did research, we exploded a lot of that. So I think there's something for me important about going in with, I think something along like these lines, but let's chat about it. So I had a group of seven brilliant dancers, seven, including myself.
I love it. Do include yourself.
Lauren Potter, Leah Marojevich, Steph McMahon, Bun Kobayashi, Connor Scott, Samir Kennedy, and then I'm working with producer Kat Bridge, and then James Keane is working on sound. Then we would move and we would chat and we would explode a lot of these ideas. So the way that I work really invites a conversation with the people in the room to not just respond, but to shape the direction of it. So we started to think a little bit more about if it wasn't a set piece of choreography, if it was improvisation scores, for example, what wider idea of dance might we be able to work with that we passed on rather than muscle memory, for example, and something which is set and specific. So we played with different scores and we started to think about ideas of 100, counting to 100, like dealing with this 100 idea. And I'm going to talk about where I'm at now. So I was thinking about what can we imagine in the future? And it was something to do with a ground and a moving body. So the assumption or the need, the conditions we need to dance are a surface and people. And then I started to think about floors, carpets, hopscotch, markings, tape, like what might this ground be? And then started to kind of get this idea of like commissioning a carpet. So what we did in the room is we taped out a 5 by 5 meter square. And I started to think around how might we have a surface where this dance happens. So that what I'm planning now is I'm actually using lockdown to create a rug myself. So I'm weaving it myself with donated t-shirts. So 1 square meter at a time, which are then going to be kind of put together, butted together or woven together to make a surface, a place, a kind of a location for this dance to happen. So basically, whilst dancers change and audiences change and we all die off, there is some continuity in this kind of piece of design, this object, which is going to, or, you know, has a materiality, has a wear, it will age through time. And it might just be a kind of a little bit of thread by 100 years time. But to start to think about not a content or a specific choreography as the continuity, but an idea of a place. And that's what the carpet kind of replaced, if you like. So then we started to think about what might be an expanded idea of this kind of movement score, what might be we busy with on this carpet. And I felt uneasy about this kind of group of seven dancers doing this thing. And our initial idea was that each dancer would find another dancer, which I did like. It was this kind of passing on of role and passing on of our established politics, for example, or values or the physical scores. And actually through lockdown, I decided I wanted to really expand that. So what I'm thinking now is that it's a very simple score, which is a slowing of the body. So through our research, we would do like 1 hour of slow motion. And I think slow motion is a slightly problematic term. So I'm trying to let go of it because it assumes a certain speed. And I'm trying to really open up to different dancers with different backgrounds and physical experiences so that a slowing might be a bit more of a subjective, relative thing for different people in a kind of accessible sense. So slowing the body. And in that sense, it doesn't need a rehearsal period so that I can invite. What I'm thinking now is 100 dancers take part over 10 days, 10 new dancers each day. And what they take part in is a 10-hour durational slowing of the body. So if you imagine the rug, you arrive at the space, there's the rug, there's a group of 10 of you, and you're going to participate in this slowing score. And with another 10 the next day. So a kind of community, if you like, a whole constellation of dancers from that area taking part in the work. In 5 years' time, the carpet travels somewhere else, and another community of 100 present or, yeah, hold the work. And that this work happens every 5 years. So I think there's 20 iterations over the 100 years, but it can geographically, almost like a magic carpet, move to different places. So then, with a very simple score, you could turn up on the day and take part in this work. And obviously, I'm trying to be really conscious of who is invited to take part and really expand through all the different spectrums of difference, who gets to be embodying the work. And something that we did in the research was this idea that while you're moving, at any point, you can say, in case you're wondering, I'm thinking about. And it would provide this little window into the thinking of the dancer, or what thought is generated in the act of moving. Like, how do we think as we move? How can dance be a container for thinking? How can the dancing body generate new thinking? How does slowing affect the mind somehow? So what we're now doing is, at any point, anyone can elicit elect to just say, in case you're wondering, I'm thinking about. So it's kind of punctuations. The whole thing is being scribed. So we're capturing all of these different sensations, feelings, images, ideas, suggestions that are generated through the moving body, so that we start to build an archive of thought, if you like. So rather than what can the body do, how does it store information, it's a little bit more, if we move together with this kind of consciousness, what comes up for us? And we found it to be really, it's just really, really emotional, I have to say. And I think that because of the timeline of the project, there's something about being differently in the body, which has the, not just the gravity, but partly the focus, the enormity, the scale, the epic scale of the project through this slowing somehow asks for a particular kind of attention from the dancer and a particular kind of attention from the people who witness the work. So we're not saying it's a performance, and we're not saying they're audience members. This work will happen whether it's witnessed or not, but you're welcome to come and be with the work. So, but I love the idea of like being with work. I've been to see, been to witness works like Xavier Le Roi at Pompidou in Paris, Untitled series, where you're really like there present with the work, but it's not demanding your attention. It's not impressing you. It's not attending to your eye or your intellect in some specific way. You get to be in your body with these dancers while they're in their bodies. And it's a different way of kind of experiencing dancing, which I love. So the only other element I'm going to talk about for now is that there's maybe two more things. There's books. So at any point, the dancers can leave the score while the other nine continue, and you can start to write about your experience of being part of it. These books will accumulate. So you might open that book, and there's the writing of the person from 5 years ago, or 15, or 75 years ago, and you contribute to this an experiential written dancer perspective archive, as well as the scribed piece. And then also, I'm thinking to do a kind of bit of a podcast series in the lead up. So I'll be chatting to different people who deal with future forecasting or archiving or environment or anthropology to get different kind of perspectives on kind of future thinking, I suppose, or to reflect back on the project or to hear from other artists with their longitudinal projects. So that as you come to witness the work, you can also put in headphones and hear about these conversations as you witness the work. So, well, there's kind of layers of experience of being with the dancing and being with the project, which inform and layer up your experience of what it might be like to make a work through time or to send a work into time. Because I won't be there to see the end of it, I don't think, you know.
What happens at 100 years? Do you know?
Well, I think in 100 years' time, we will have a body of text, which I think of it like a kind of a litmus test, or a kind of like a gauging the temperature of that time. So even if you imagine it launching later this year or next year, so much of what comes up for people will be about the experience of lockdown or coming out of lockdown, what it is to be with other bodies again. We don't know if we this work will witness ecological, political, cultural change that we have. we can't even imagine. Even the conversation around AI, you know, like, do robots or AI get to be part of this project in 100 years time? Because that's a very real projection. You know, the more I read, the more I'm like, with augmented bodies and enhanced chemical makeup, like, it might not be a kind of metal robot, but there'll be all kinds of versions of us. And what might the politics around that be? You know, what is it to say you have to be a fleshy born human to take part? That might be the most inappropriate old school thinking in 100 years time, that this work is immediately outdated or inappropriate to present in 100 years time. So there's so much unknown. And I think the potential for risk and failure, you know, it's a project of hope. It's a project of, we don't know what's going to happen with this, but we hope that there might be people that care about what we care about in the future. But in 100 years time, I guess there will be this kind of, well, some bit of carpet, I hope, something left. But I guess, kind of, yeah, a body of a built, picture of what this last 100 years, what happened through that time somehow. I guess I'm not thinking so much about the result then. I'm thinking about the practice of being with dance through time, being in your moment in time and understanding it within a longitudinal, long-term thinking. So there's an idea called cathedral thinking, which is a bit like the architect of Notre Dame or Sagrada de Familia or any kind of long-term project, you know, that you initiate it, but you know that you won't be there to see it completed, but that you're entrusting it to future generations to continue or take care of. So it's really about setting something in motion, which invites us to think differently about, for example, how to be good ancestors, which is a term which is used around a lot of long-term thinking, which is like, how can we make decisions now which benefit the long-term and bring a different consciousness to how we are in the moment, which is more environmentally aware, for example. So it's almost like an environment project without going, let's look at climate change and dance, you know? It's already inherently built into the project that we have to think differently about future generations of dancers who aren't born yet, but who might take part in the project, you know? And how does that change who we are to be that empathetic, for example?
There's such a deep empathy level there, isn't there? It's a really beautiful thing. I'm so inspired by the whole idea of that. It's not about the outcome. It's not about this is what I want to happen in 100 years, any of that. It's not about the end result. It's about the process and the people and those moments. I just wish there was more of that, because a lot of the time the focus really is just on the end, isn't it? But actually, we learn so much before that, and it's a shame. I'm talking from my opinion, but it's a shame it's not shared sometimes, because that's where the beauty is, in a way.
I think for me, this is something about really moving away from the idea of product. Like, nobody can see the whole of this project. Nobody can understand its absolute fullness. We only experience it at our own point in time. But also that what is more important than what happens on the carpet is the structure, the thinking, the thing that is absent, like what came before and what comes later. So taking the attention and the calculation off the body, off what happens in front of you, to a bigger thinking. How can we use dance to think about environment? How can we use dance to think about politics and sustainability? Among many, many other things, use dance to think about empathy. So rather than what is the body doing and am I interested? It's like, I've seen work where I'm slightly bored in the best sense. Like, it doesn't demand something of me. I get to be in my body, be with the dance, like I said before. And I suppose I'm okay for your attention to wander. It's important for your attention to wander. If it's a 10-hour day practice, you might be there at the beginning, you might be there at the end, you might be there in the middle, or sit through the whole thing. But I hope that we can be with the body, the bodies, the group body, your own body, and give time, or not in a religious sense, but there's something about kind of dance and collectivity and gathering, which, you know, it can really occupy a space because it's not language led necessarily. I mean, this is partly, but we can be with each other in collections and constellations, which can do something profound. You know, it's not about theatre in the sense of meaning and jeopardy and the mind in that sense, but it opens up space. Dance can, I think, open up space for us to be with ourselves and our thinking while we are with the moving body. And I suppose that's the bit that I enjoy more and more and more. And theatres do something very different. Theatre, you're passive, you're sat, well, maybe not passive, but you're organized into seating banks and you're watching something over there, which, because you paid for an expensive ticket and you're going to have a glass of wine in the interval, maybe you want it to provide for you in a way which I know that my work is never going to provide for people. Because I'm asking you to operate on a different way, you know, in a different mode. And yeah, I'm excited for it. I mean, there's lots of unknown and it will develop, and it will develop through further conversations with my producer and the dancers I work with. But I feel like where we got to is the most expanded sense of different kinds of dancers of all ages, backgrounds, disabled dancers, neurodiverse dancers, you know, like who can be invited to the table through the broadening, the expanding of this project, rather than those seven dancers that I worked with, for example. By it being over 10 days, hopefully more people can get to come and see it in their lunch break, or, you know, in the evening after work, or how can it reach more people and be accessible in that sense? So a lot of the most recent thinking is about how to broaden it, you know, rather than it make it a really niche contemporary dance exclusive thing for just those seven people and who they choose to pass it on to. You know, so that's through lockdown and the rethinking that's been enabled. And I wouldn't have put this into the world in that way if I'd done it a year ago.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember the last time you spoke about this project when I came to your workshop in 2019, and you were just talking about it then. I remember you talking about the seven dancers, and I can hear you talking about it now. It's like, wow,
Yeah.
I can really see that thinking in there. And it's really interesting that that's come out from lockdown, and you feel that that may not have come out in that way had this not happened.
Yeah. The challenge is trying to find a space to do it in. I think that I basically think it needs to be in London because I want to really have a broad spectrum of people taking part. And for example, I'm now based in the Southwest, and it's just like, for one, really, really white. Yeah. I'm not prepared to put this work into the world if it's not diverse in that sense and many other senses. So I think it does need to be in London. But as I was chatting to David Harradine, who's been a bit of a mentor for me on this, it kind of needs a museum or a gallery because they're in the process and practice of caretaking works into time rather than the immediacy of theatre, like what is happening now, what is happening with your next project next year, what is new. We need a kind of organization who could work with us that holds the records, the archive, looks after the carpet, cares about something which is time-based in a different way from the way that a theatre would. Know quite where it's going to happen, but I kind of want a village hall in the middle of London.
Oh, that would be amazing. I wish there was a village hall in the middle of London. Oh, so that is that the next sort of part is working that sort of thing out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to get hold of my loom again and start weaving. I've done 14 1 meter, 1 meter rugs. I've done 16. I've got 14 to go, I think. So I need to get weaving. But it's nice because I can listen to podcasts and I can, you know, audio books and do other things, a bit like knitting. You know, I've got, I can do it quite manually and be elsewhere in my mind. Yeah, liaising with organizations, trying to find the right home for this work. And essentially, that's individuals who care about it enough to really invest in it and look after it into the future, you know. So I was thinking of V&A, but then they've just now seem to be cutting their performance department, theatre department. And this a project like this is going to deal with those kind of risks. You know, what if they looked after 5 years already and then now we were finding out that they weren't going to? You know, it's going to have to mutate in different ways. But yeah, liaising with organizations, that's the next fun bit, and applying for funding from the Arts Council.
That's the fun parts that come with all of this.
Unless I can find a really rich individual like Brian Eno or someone like that.
Oh yeah. Shout
Already in.
out to Brian Eno.
I should be a bit braver actually and start to try and contact people like that because it's going to be through empathetic individuals, you know, that this is going to work. So even when we talk about organizations, of course, that's made up of individuals who care. You know, I think we can easily make those things abstract, but actually, they're people in a different part of the ecology of performance, you know.
Right. Well, Theo, I'm going to finish off with the question that we're asking all of our guests in this series. And it is, I keep saying the question and it's two questions in one because I'm terrible like that. So it is, which three things would you like to spend more time on in your life? And what about less time?
Wow.
I know, it's quite a big one, isn't it?
This is huge. I'd like to spend more time on... I have been through this year, and I want to continue that even when we're not in lockdown. And that's being in nature. I just feel like my big walks have... Well, they stimulate my attention and my senses in a way which is different from other experiences. I've often felt like in studios we're a little bit like, why do we put ourselves in like a white box with like no sound, no smell, no changing visuals, you know? And actually being in nature, I'm like, everything is sparking and it changes my kind of physiology, or it wakes me up in a way. And also being around that kind of green space and change and transformation feels like a really useful reminder of our own truth of change and transformation. So being in nature, continuing the kind of like political work of understanding myself and the limits of my perspective, and the importance of getting multiple readings of anything and hearing and listening. I think there's a real continued importance for white men particularly to listen, and I think that's really prescient today with the Me Too, the kind of Me Too experience after this girl's gone missing in London. Like, care around those kind of experiences for women and the threat that they're under from violent men, as one example. But yeah, I think the continued importance to do the work and understand your edges and try and work out how you can be, yeah, making space, listening, part of an ecology in every sense, not just within art making, but in how we are in the world. And something else, I think, yeah, making time for family and friends. I think through this period, I've really appreciated the value of where do we find our kinship in all senses, and to give more time to that. Something I'd like to have or do less of is looking outward for validation. I think the sabbatical that I started over a year ago was really having got myself in a real tizzy, for want of a better word, around, do the dancers like me? Does the commissioner like the work I've made? Do the audience get it? Do the writers like it? Like, I've been thinking a lot about codependence recently, and I've then was like applying that to how we make work and how we might outsource our act of validation to what people think of us and think of the work that we make, rather than going, I know this was true for me. I know that I made this from a kind of honest place and with integrity. And no matter what goes down, I have to hold on to that. I've always thought about it in this way of like having a thick skin and then having a thin skin in order to make work at all. But I think there's another way of thinking about it, which is just sticking with your own sense of self-value, self-care around the artworks that we make, not just how we are in the world, but to not be displaced if someone doesn't get it or doesn't like it. Like, there's other ways of holding true to what you do which are not externalized. And I think it's, as a people pleaser, it's taken me a long time to work out how to do that, but I have to really commit myself to that going forwards.
I hear you on that, Theo. I'm a people pleaser too. It's really, really, really hard.
It's a small beast.
Oh, God. It's never going to end. It's a kind of, you know, a daily journey. Yeah. But I think having the awareness of that and the self-awareness and the level of self-care to go, I know that I feel like this because of this or whatever, and actually being able to understand that, process that for yourself and choose how you want to move forwards with that is a really amazing thing.
Yeah. And that might just show up in like, I'm going to take a breath before I respond in any given moment. Like, I'm just going to like be with myself, check in with my feelings. What do I need? What do I know to be true? How do I want to respond to any given situation? There's all ways in which it can show up, but I think that in itself has been a recent lesson. Like, I think I'm in a bit of a self-reflective thing, as many of us are, and yeah, more choice around how we are in the world and how we make work and what we expect back from it, I suppose. It's confusing because we want to communicate with the work. We want a response. We want it to reach people, but it can get very confused with then it being valid, that being the only source of validation. So I can see how it's happened.
Yeah, definitely. It's that sort of not separating yourself from the work so that you can't make the work that comes from that place, because it is coming from a really deep place for most people, isn't it? And it sounds like with your work, it really is coming from that vulnerable, authentic place. And you don't want to separate it. So it's like, oh, my work's over there and I'm over here, because you're not, it that just doesn't help us make that work. But then when it comes to the external response, that's the moment where it's sort of very tricky and very complex to know that that's not about you as a person, but your work is so personal that, oh, it's an endless catch 22 situation, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have to take care as to where we put our attention, where we, put the work, like where is it going and what is it that finding its right audience or how is it experienced and how do you create the right conditions for it to be experienced optimally? But I think you're also right, like it's about boundaries. Like maybe I'm not going to read that review right now because I'm hungry and emotionally volatile or whatever, like to be clear with healthy boundaries. And I didn't really know about all that stuff. I was like, what are boundaries? What is that? And now I'm like, okay, I know better what I need in relation to people, but also in relation to my work.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's been absolutely fascinating, and it's going to really stay with me what you've said about artistry and how that relates to our lives. And I'm so excited for Century Project as well.
Oh.
I wish you all the best with funding and all of that side of things that comes with this too. And
So much, and thank you for putting this podcast in the world. Things only happen because people make them happen, and you made this,
oh.
so just to know that you're offering something to your community is just brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
What an episode. A huge thank you to Theo for such a wonderfully curious, caring, and honest exploration into artistry. Theo's thoughts around the role of art and our own individual roles in society have really stayed with me. I'm so excited to see how Century Project develops too. Do go to the show notes to find all the info on Theo's work and the projects he mentioned, including Future Library and the morning open practice online sessions. I'd love to hear your thoughts on artistry too. How does artistry feature in your life? Has this chat sparked any inspirations or ideas? Get in touch and let me know. You can email me on hello@curiousmotion.org.uk or send me a message via Curious Motion's social media. All our info is in the show notes. Next week, we'll be exploring another of our values. This time it's, wait for it, curiosity! Definitely one we couldn't miss. I'm joined by Linda Freeman, who works with the library teams here in Calderdale. It's a curious exploration into stories, people, and community, so you don't want to miss it. Until then, remember, tune into your body, be kind to yourself, and stay curious. Bye.